Music Session number 10420, Rule 10.
Colonel W.I. Watson, Reel 10. We finished the last tape at Dieppe Hospital, Colonel. What exactly happened then?
I was in hospital there for about 10 days, I think, or 10 days. I don't think much longer. And it was a much more relaxed hospital than what I was to experience when I crossed over the channel to Hatfield House Hospital in Hertfordshire. The staff were extremely kind and very pleasant, and the nurses, I think, were reservists, army reservists that had been called up for the purpose. And in front of the hospital itself was, I believe, the old Hotel Metropole, right on the seafront, and in between the hotel and the shore was a garden in which there was a huge red cross made of red brick and white chalk, and that was to protect the hospital from any air raid. And now, I at the time was very depressed, having lost my job, and I got a letter from the general telling me that he'd help me if he could in any way in the future. But he thought that it would be a good thing for me to have experience with a battalion with a view to ultimately getting command. As a matter of fact, anybody serving in the A department of the War Office never really made much progress. But I was very depressed at this because I was being plugged with penicillin, which makes you depressed. And there was an awfully nice chaplain there in the hospital. I have a feeling that he was a patient, but he said, don't reply, accept what the general said, because when one door shuts, another one always opens. And I did, and I left it at that. I had a splendid sister there who was looking after me. I had a room to myself. She came in, she was a jock, and she came in one night and said to me, oh, Major, I've now brought your medicine. And she brought a bottle of champagne from underneath her apron and put it into the cupboard by my bedside. Well, then I eventually improved, and I could take walks round Dieppe. But ere long, the message came, or the information came, that the Germans were being obstreperous, and that anybody who was not likely to recover within 7 days had to be evacuated to England. Well, as I wasn't likely to be fit again in 7 days, I was put on the list to be evacuated to England.
So this was a purely military hospital?
A purely military hospital, and yes. It had been taken over. You see, it had been in a hotel at one time and had been taken over by the military.
Do you recall any of the types of cases that were in the hospital?
Oh, yes. Yes. Now, there were cases of wounding by bombs or anything like that. And there were sick cases, I call sick, like myself. Yes. But all the casualties that were not likely to recover in 7 days, I think it was, or 9 days, 7 days, I think it was, had to be evacuated. And I was put on a hospital ship, SS Brighton, which had been converted, painted white with a red cross on its flanks, and put on a hospital ship, and with a good many others. We did the 3.5-hour journey from Dieppe to New Haven. The staff on the on board were extremely helpful and looked after us very well. One of the things, if you've got congestion of the lungs, which I had, was that sitting up was rather came very tiring for you. You felt it in your chest very considerably. And so I think I'm right in saying that the MO on board, or one of the MO, young MOs on board, actually let me have his bunk to lie down, because it was much easier for me to lie down, less painful than sitting up the whole way. Well, we got to New Haven, and there was every conceivable doctor under the sun waiting waiting for us, including two, a black doctor, which now is so common, but in those days was very rare. There was a military doctor, black, and they were all fussing around us and giving us all the attention we could needed. There was RAF doctors as well. And we were put in a train, a hospital train, and sent to Dorking. Now, I believe I should have been sent, put on a hospital train and sent to Newcastle-on-Tyne, but I wasn't. And when we got to Dorking, we were put in a coach and sent the whole way across London to Hertfordshire, to Hatfield House. And it was sitting up the whole time, which was awful, really terrible. And we got to Hatfield House Hospital, I think about 11:30 at night, absolutely worn out, having had to sit upright in the coach the whole time. And to add to all the distress, the driver lost his way going through London. Well, atmosphere in Hatfield House Hospital wasn't nearly so relaxed as it had been in the Hotel Metropole in Dieppe. I was put into a room with Colonel Victor Yate from the 2nd Battalion. He'd been commanding the 2nd Battalion in France and had tummy trouble, and I'd been put in a room with him and another chap who I think had been blown up. I'm not sure. There was one very serious casualty opposite, in the room opposite. But this fellow who was in the room with me and Victor Yate, I think had been blown up on a petrol tanker in Brest Harbour within about 10 minutes of the ship pulling into the berth. He was mentally very distressed, and he had to have a light on all night, which was really disturbing. But eventually he was moved. And really, the hospital itself, which was the 21st London, was in this superb house. Hatfield House, you couldn't have been housed in a better, but beautiful place. And all the fittings in the wards, like the wash basins and the towel rails and that sort of thing, were all put on boards. And it only needed a couple of boards into the superb walls. Well, I was hauled into, I think it was Queen Anne's room, for an inspection of my lungs. And I went down there, and it was a coldish day, and I touched the screen with my naked chest and started to shiver a bit, and the doctor who was looking at my lungs on the screen said, stand still, don't fidget about. And I said, well, it's damn cold. And he then said to me, you live in the country. And I said, yes, I live in the country, that's perfectly true. And you don't smoke. And I said, yes, that is also perfectly true, I don't smoke. And he turned to the sergeant that was helping him and said, there you are, sergeant, I can tell every time. And off you go. And I left, got dressed, and left and went back to my room or the sitting room where we were sitting. I had an old aunt who lived not far away, and I went to see her. We could stay out. I was now improving. We could stay out till about 7:30 at night, or 7 or 7:30 at night, and she came over for me, and I spent two occasions and after. It was a night watch on the top. An officer had to be on duty on the top of the... there had to be sentries looking out of the windows. There had to be prowler guards going round the castle walls at night. Patrols went deep into the bushes and the shrubberies all round the castle. He was quite certain that the castle would be the third objective for Hitler. I never knew what the first other two were, the first and the second, but I soon learned that Arnsmith Castle was number three. He would never relax. Now, during my stay there, I think he was awfully pleased that I was there. I was outside, and I'd had experience, and I'd been to France. And he was terribly keen to get me interested in the place. And he did relax on two occasions. He took me fishing in Waskley Reservoir, and I think in one of the other ones in Weardale Burnup or something like that. And all the time, I was completely relaxed. I mean, fishing to me was absolute marvelous relaxation. And I caught the trout, but he never did, you know. He was a brilliant fisherman, but he was worrying the whole time. He never relaxed, and he never got the idea of Hitler's arrival out of his mind. Of course, the poor chap did in the end commit suicide in the castle.
How did this affect the rest of the...
Well, I tell you what struck me that was so odd when I got there. He would write letters to George Stobart, his training officer, and the adjutant would write letters to him, and everybody would write letters backwards and forwards when they were in the same castle. And they could walk down the passage and spoken. I took my tour of went on the castle top, and I remember one evening when I was up there in the dark, they were bombed Middlesbrough, and all the pheasants, cock pheasants in the woods all round the castle, all crowed like anything. And on another occasion when I was up there, I counted, I think, something like 40 blimps or balloons all round Newcastle and Middlesbrough and the county of Durham to keep the aeroplanes off. Another occasion, I went to Arsworth Aerodrome to arrange for an anti-parachute exercise, and I did various sand table exercises there too. And I remember a lecture there extremely well. There was the member for Parliament for Darlington was a chap called Charles Peat, and he had joined up the 6th Battalion at the beginning of the war. He'd won the MC in the First World War, but he joined in and he became in the second in command of the 6th Battalion, but he didn't make the grade. And he gave us a lecture, and all the NCOs had to attend, on the Houses of Parliament, and a bill going through Parliament, and what it was. Do you know that it was the most brilliant lecture I've heard for years? And all the NCOs really took it all in. And that was Charles Peat. He eventually didn't make the grade at all and had to leave. But he gave us that lecture, it really was fascinating how an Act of Parliament went through the Houses of Commons and the House of Lords.
What was your position in the training?
Nothing, really. Nothing. I assisted in training. I gave one or two sand table exercises. I had to go to Usworth Aerodrome, Usworth Aerodrome prepare a discussion on anti-parachute work. I took my tour of duties as the officer on duty. Well, then the BEF started to arrive from France, and I went to sent to Durham to start with to receive the 6th Battalion or any remnants of the Durham Infantry Brigade, the DLI Brigade, R151 Brigade, in Durham. However, I wasn't there very long, and I left it to themselves to get settled in there. But one thing I do remember was the most appalling explosion early one morning in Durham. And this turned out to be the sappers blasting to put in charges under the bridges, the most beautiful bridges, the old Elvet bridges in the city, in case they had to be blown up should Hitler arrive. But then I left Durham and I was sent to Newcastle, to Fenham Barracks in Newcastle.
Can I just ask you, what state were the troops in coming back from Dunkirk?
Well, some were in a pretty poor state, but others, well, as I mentioned, was extraordinary. I was sent primarily to Fenham Barracks for the reception of the 12th Division, but there were odd parties arriving, little bodies of 3 and 4 or 12 or a dozen from all sorts of units. But the primary, I was sent for the reception of the 12th Division. Now, the procedure was that no matter how tired the chap was or the party were, they had to go through a barrack room and their name and address and number and their unit had to be taken down. Now, that was absolutely essential because if they didn't, they were posted as missing. And then they were given a meal, and then and it was a jolly good meal too, and then they could relax.
But what date is this?
This is I went to I think the last day of May, or just about the end of May, I went to Fenham Barracks. Spent 1 or 2 days there arranging for the arrival of these various parties. But everybody was who did arrive, bar the 12th Division, who were our main people, uh, were frightfully appreciative of what we did. I know we got a catering advisor to come and organize the catering from an army catering advisor towards, there were, I mean, on some occasion, there were a large party of 337 units. And that you can see their names had to be taken. Well, primarily, I went to Newcastle for the reception of the 12th Division, and they really were awful. They were, they didn't want any help. I was woken up on one occasion at 1 o'clock in the morning, told by the movement control down in Newcastle, a party was coming at one. I had to wake up the caterers and the cooks and everybody. They never turned up till three. And on another occasion, I went down to Newcastle Station for the 12th a battalion, I think it was, of the 12th Division. I'm not sure, it wasn't from Queens, West Surrey's. And there was the staff captain, all dressed up to the eyes. I think he was a guardsman. And I said, well, now I've got buses for you. We'll take you up to the barracks. No, we don't want buses, we march. Well, the unfortunate chaps, they may have been absolute splendid soldiers, but I'm guaranteed they'd have much rather been taken up from the central station in Newcastle to Fenham Barracks by bus rather than have to march the mile uphill the whole way. Well, in the end, we got so tired with them, the arrival of the, and so tired with the 12th Division, that we shot them off all, out, turned them out into billets all round Hexham and Corbridge and told them to get on with it while we dealt with all the others. Well, this finally faded away. And the numbers died down, and the got less and less. So I then went back to round about the middle of June. I went back to Barnsmouth, and I eventually received a posting order to the 6th Battalion.
Before we leave Barnsmouth, and to take you back to when you met the 151 Brigade coming back from France, what kind of stories were you hearing at this time? Because I believe the 6th Battalion particularly split, didn't it?
No, the 6th Battalion were absolutely split up. And some didn't even come out of Dunkirk. Some came out of Boulogne.
Did you hear any discussion on this from the troops?